Welcome to Soccer Morning on World Soccer Talk. Here's your host, Jason Davis.
Good morning, everybody. Happy Wednesday. Welcome into Soccer Morning here on WorldSoccerTalk.com. Thank you for joining us. Wonderful Wednesday morning. Bright and sunny where you are, I hope, because it's not where I am. It's been dreary and rainy and yucky for a lot of the week so far. It's been wet. And it seemed to be dreary and yucky for the United States men's national team last night in Frisco, Texas. No rain, but there was certainly not a high level of play on that field as the United States downed Honduras 2-1 and got a little, I don't know, fortunate in that victory. Certainly two set pieces from Glenn Dempsey is not the way that you want to go and win your first Gold Cup match if you're looking to set a tone for the tournament. But they got the job done. Talk about that game and some other U.S. soccer storylines. Our friend Charlie Bohm joined us in a couple of minutes. Talk to Charlie about that particular formation and the players that Jurgen Klinsmann used in that match. Because you look and you can find a lot to be annoyed about. Jossi Zardes, is he a midfielder? Nah, I'm not so sure about that. Is DeAndre Yedlin a midfielder? Or if he's a midfielder, is he a midfielder that you want out there for 90 minutes covering a flank against a team that's pressing you the way that Honduras was? Is that center back pairing the pairing we're going to see throughout the tournament? Because it's awfully young, awfully green, didn't really respond well to the intensity of a Gold Cup group stage match against a team. Again, give Honduras incredible credit. They took it to the United States. Jorge Luis Pinto has made a major difference with that Honduras team. They might be trouble down the line. The United States needed Clint Dempsey to pop up in the right place at the right time. They needed lots of last-second interventions on the defensive end. They needed Honduras to not be able to hit the target. And they needed Brad Guzan to make a save or two. They conceded, but only the one. So the United States moves on. Meanwhile, in the first game of the evening, Panama and Haiti tied 1-1. Panama up late in that match, and then Haiti found an equalizer. Good for them. That takes a lot of pressure off of Honduras and the United States, to be quite honest with you, that game ended in a draw. In the U.S. women's national team realm, midfielder Lauren Holliday, formerly Lauren Cheney, has announced her retirement from international soccer at the age of 27, talking about going and starting a family. She's married to New Orleans Pelicans player Drew Holliday, who has been an incredible supporter of the national team, of his wife in the national team. I saw a picture of him and whoever that eagle is that's dating Julie Johnston. They were together hanging out, celebrating the U.S. women. So Lauren Holliday steps aside from the international game. Quite the resume for Lauren Holliday. Absolutely no, I mean, obviously for a fan, it's a little disappointing to see her leave at such a young age. But with everything that she's accomplished, she certainly has nothing left to prove. Speaking of the U.S. women, they'll go to New York on Friday. They were in L.A. yesterday for their celebration tour. They'll be in New York on Friday, and they'll receive a ticker tape parade down the Canyon of Heroes in New York City, the traditional stretch that the championship teams go down in their celebration parades. It's not ticker tape anymore. I think it's confetti, but the effect is essentially the same. The U.S. women, the first. I don't think that this has ever been done for a national team, and maybe I'm wrong about that. But the city of New York deciding to give the U.S. women the parade they deserve with that ticker tape parade down the Canyon of Heroes. Atlanta United FC has made their name official and unveiled their logo ahead of their 2017 inaugural season. If you watched any of that last night ahead of the U.S. game, you saw the logo. If you're on Twitter, you saw the logo. It's a big A. There's like some black and white, black and red stripes behind it. It's a circle. It's gold. The actual A and everything is gold. Sort of lukewarm on it, but it's not as bad as it could have been. Let's say it that way. Still not a fan of the name. Still think they could have gone a little bit more creative. But in terms of that logo, it is what it is, I guess. I don't know. I find it difficult to work up a whole lot of angry energy over these things. The United name offended me a little bit because it copies names already, a name already in the league, and they had several good options on the table. The logo is a little bit of a different story. Raheem Sterling has been asked to, left off of Liverpool's preseason Asian tour. This is likely leading into his departure from Liverpool. He wants to leave. Pretty sure the fans don't want him around anymore. So it's probably best for everybody involved if Sterling just decides to move on. But there needs to be a deal made. Liverpool has already rejected two offers from Manchester City, but Manuel Pellegrini's side are expected to return with a third bid, which will be close to what Liverpool values Sterling at, which is £50 million, $77 million. It's a lot of money for Mr. Sterling. Back home here in North America, CONCACAF has severed ties with Traffic Sports. This comes after their reform statement the other day. Whether or not that bears fruit, we'll see. But CONCACAF and Traffic Sports have decided to part ways and dissolve their commercial rights agreement. Confederation said that this was a mutual decision. Of course, really, Traffic really had no other option considering what's been going on. The investigations, Traffic founder Jose Javila has already pled guilty to a number of charges in the indictment from the FBI and the Department of Justice. Aaron Davidson has been indicted and is looking for a plea deal. What this does is free up the rights to the next four Gold Cups, 2015, 17, 19, and 21, as well as seven seasons of the CONCACAF Champions League, plus other sundry tournaments. Those are your biggies, and Traffic no longer has the rights to them. Paul Tenorio down in Orlando is reporting, it's very unlikely that Javier Chicharito Hernandez signs with the Orlando City. Negotiations between MLS and Hernandez have stalled over the fact that Hernandez wants $10 million a year. Now, that may not be more than he's worth, but certainly would be an MLS record, and you have to wonder if MLS is willing to step up. Now, they did step up and pay $8 million a year to Andrea Pirlo, and they've offered a reported $9 million a year to Giovanni Dos Santos. So if Chicharito Hernandez could have the impact that a lot of us think he could, why wouldn't you pay him $10 million a year? I don't know. Chicharito is asking for north of $10 million, so maybe it's a little bit more than that. A number that would make him by far the highest paid player in the league. That number also does not factor in the transfer fee. Ah, maybe here's the rub. Manchester United reportedly asking for $12 million for that. There you go. This league would benefit from Chicharito Hernandez, but that may be a bridge too far for Orlando and MLS. All right, let's step aside for a moment, and when we come back, we'll have Charlie Bohm from MLSsoccer.com and SoccerWire.com. We'll talk to him about the game last night, maybe the U.S. women, maybe Andrea Pirlo, maybe Chicharito Hernandez. You never know. Don't go anywhere. Be right back. You're talking too loud. This week, the U.S. men's national team kicks off its campaign to try to win back-to-back Gold Cups for the first time since 2005 and 2007. As many of you know, the past month of Women's World Cup and Copa America coverage have been augmented by our sponsor, Rabble.tv. They've given people like me, Jerry Dubois, and Thomas Floyd an opportunity to provide you with an alternate commentary to several memorable games. Now that the Gold Cup is kicking off, we're going to continue our relationship with Rabble. Each U.S. game over the next week will feature a Rabble audio broadcast, including Friday's game, where I'll be bringing you USA against Haiti, as well as Monday, July 13th game between USA and Panama, which will feature audio dialogue from World Soccer Talk's Kartik Krishnire. With Rabble, the concept is simple. All you have to do is tune into the broadcast on TV, press the mute button, and then head on over to Rabble.tv to listen to me sharing my analysis. And if you have an iPhone, install the Rabble TV app and add a comment to the broadcast message board, then listen live via the app. Cheer on the red, white, and blue with Rabble.tv today.
Welcome back to Soccer Morning on World Soccer Talk with Jason Davis.
Here we are back on Soccer Morning, joined by our friend Charlie Bohm. You can find him on Twitter at CBOEHM. He's on SoccerWire.com. He's on MLSSoccer.com. He's in a bunch of different places. And he joins us from lovely, humid Washington, D.C. this morning. Charlie, how are you?
I'm doing great, Jason. Doing great. Glad to be here.
Glad to have you. Let's talk about what the U.S. men did last night in Frisco, Texas. 2-1 over Honduras. We can talk about results-based analysis, but I don't know that there's any place that that's more appropriate than the Gold Cup group stage against a country like Honduras.
I think we probably had an idea of how this conversation would have gone thinking about it 24 hours ago, and it didn't quite unfold that way. Everybody expects Gold Cup games to be a slog, but I don't think many people would have predicted the U.S. would be outpossessed, would be outshot, that would have arguably the busier goalkeeper in Brad Guzan. It was the result they needed. That was the bottom line to get off on a good start, but this was not proactive, nor would I consider this next level football.
Okay, so are we going to sound any alarm bells? Are we going to move to DEFCON 4 in light of what we witnessed last night? If only because I don't know that I trust Jurgen Klinsmann to fix it, mostly because of the personnel, because I see that as the major problem.
Yeah, you know, it's certainly no alarm bells. He's taken a professional, let's say a professional and a practical approach to this tournament. We can talk all day about the roster. I think this is a strange roster and one that's not necessarily well suited for the 4-4-2 shape that he seems pretty set on employing at the moment. But he's got a lot of experience. He's got veteran savvy, and that certainly came to the fore. I mean, you had two classic strikers finishes from Clint Dempsey. You had some really important moments from Michael Bradley, even though he wasn't quite as dominant as I had expected him to be yesterday, coming into the game. But he was class when he needed to be. The delivery on the game winner from a set piece was fantastic. Honduras, a little strangely, I think, were kind of a mess on set pieces. The first goal came in the aftermath of a corner kick. But, I certainly would hope that we'll see some improvement over the course of the month, because I don't know that this is the kind of performance that's going to get them where they need to go in the business end of the tournament.
All right, so the veteran savvy comes to the fore in the form of Michael Bradley, set piece delivery, Clint Dempsey getting on the end of things, just putting the ball in the net, as we were told is his job, as he's no longer the captain, Charlie, and yet at a position on the field, a couple of positions where you would think experience might be worth something, and let's put in somebody who's been at least in something approaching this environment. Klinsmann goes with Ventura Alvarado, his first competitive cap, and John Brooks, who's 22 years old and has shown inconsistency throughout his U.S. men's national team time. Why? Well, you might not know why, but how did that actually manifest?
Yeah, it's interesting. We talked a lot about the age of the experience of this roster, but the defense is pretty young. He doesn't have all that much experience, and a big part of that, I think, is that Jurgen has kind of scooted a few guys to the margins, or maybe out of the picture for now, at least entirely. So his faith in Ventura Alvarado seems pretty ironclad. I think he's going with what he sees in training. He's basing a lot of that faith on the level at which Alvarado plays, which is Mexico's biggest club, Club America. So he's getting good minutes in a high level Liga MX competition, but he's out of season right now, right? So he's coming in with probably less match sharpness than some of his teammates. And I think you could kind of see that with Chandler as well. I mean, for me, Timmy Chandler remains the biggest enigma in the picture right now, definitely on this roster. And you saw signs of it again last night. I never know if he's about to hit, make a game-winning contribution, or if he's about to commit an enormous gaffe. And so when you kind of add up those pieces along the line, you have the youth of Brooks, you have the relative lack of international experience that Alvarado's working with, and then you have a real wild card like Chandler. It got a little dicey at times there. The goal in particular, I thought Alvarado's inexperience showed. Jurgen wants his defenders playing on the front foot. trying to snuff things out before they happen, but he was very much caught off the pace on the initial ball delivered into a kind of a ball designed to tease him out of his position. Mm-hmm. And he took the bait, he dived in, and he left an enormous gap that was rapidly exploited by Honduras. So a learning experience for Alvarado, I'm sure it would be Jurgen's take on that, but he's going to have to learn faster.
Yeah, absolutely. As for Timmy Chandler, he always looks like he's in discomfort when I watch him play. It never looks like he's really got that extra gear that I think is necessary at this level. And I'm not going to put Timmy Chandler on not trying. I'm not going to question his motivation. I know some people will jump from point A to point B on that. Just based on his history with this team, but I don't understand his position in the side as you do. Let's move into the midfield because I think it would be easy to say, and I did say it last night. I said that Michael Bradley and Kyle Beckerman didn't look like themselves either, but let's remember that all of these things are connected, and you also had playing on the flanks two players who were out of position.
Yeah, you know, this is Jurgen's thing. I mean, I don't know whether he thinks taking them out of their comfort zones is good in this context, or he's just sort of playing, you know, he's sort of just trying to construct what he thinks is his best 11 out of his best 11 players. We all know every U.S. coach has been in that position at some point or another where you've got 11 pieces you like, but they don't all fit in the spots that you need them to. Fabian Johnson has to be on the field. You know, we know that much, for example, but maybe he needs to be in a different place. Giassi Zardes, I think, has proved he's international level, but is he an international level wide midfielder? I don't see it. And I saw examples of him really fighting against his instincts, thinking about things rather than just playing and be getting into a flow that the sort of flow that you see him, shine in, you know, with the Galaxy. So, I don't get it. I think maybe if he tweaks the formation a bit, maybe drops a striker off and plays more of a 4-5-1 or a 4-2-3-1, however you want to look at it, maybe there's a little more comfort can be gained from there. But for now, you know, he's building everything around Beckerman and Bradley in center midfield, and I think that's sort of the point at which everything else gets done from.
It was not the most encouraging performance, and yet here's a tweet from Alex FlyGuy14 on Twitter. Don't overanalyze this, guys. Don't overanalyze it, guys. And I think we do have to fight that instinct a bit, Charlie. And the next, you know, they've got Haiti next, I believe, on Friday, and then Panama after that. And you imagine that, barring an absolute disaster, they're going to go into the quarterfinals against somebody that they should beat pretty handily. So you're looking at possibly three games that they'll be overwhelming favorites in. Not that Panama can't give them something of a game, but I wasn't impressed with their performance against Haiti. So now, you know, this is an opportunity for Klinsmann to work out those kinks within the tournament, which I suppose is the silver lining here.
The first sort of the one word that really jumped to my mind at the final whistle, my one word review, I guess, of that game was awkward. And I think that's going to continue. This was an awkward performance for the U.S. But given that, you know, kudos for getting the 3 points. The rest of this group is going to be awkward too, because yes, they are the favorites. They're also, facing by Gold Cup standards, a tough group assignment. I mean, when you look at the cream puff group that Mexico got dropped into, compared to this, you know, it's a different task for the two sort of, Goliaths in this tournament. And I think that's going to continue. Haiti is actually, I expect them to be several notches above where they were at in the last go round. You know, they've been cannon fodder at times in this tournament, but I think they've got a lot of guys playing overseas. They've got a lot more structure and organization in their preparation. They've been doing well against NASL sides in warm-up games, although that's really limited in terms of what, you know, how it gets you ready for the USMNT. But all the same, I think they're going to have to, the U.S. is going to have to sort of navigate through this very carefully. I do wonder if we're going to see some changes to the lineup. It would make a lot of sense given the short turnaround and significant travel that they have coming up. So we'll have to see what Jurgen's got in mind there.
Well, you know, what did you take away from the substitutions? Because Klinsmann, you know, they go to Europe, they play very well, they beat Germany, it's a thing. But he's got six substitutions at his disposal, and every one of them played some role in those victories. And when he has freedom in a friendly to change over his team that much, they've been pretty successful traditionally. But when it comes to the in-game adjustments, sometimes we question whether or not he, number one, makes adjustments early enough to actually impact the game, and number two, we sometimes question those actual substitutions. What did you make of how he handled it last night?
Well, I actually was musing about this during one of their European friendlies. I often wonder if coaches would be better served in some friendly environments to actually limit themselves to three substitutions, because you know there's a rule of thumb that you can kind of write off what happens after the hour mark or maybe after the 75th minute of a friendly, because the rhythm of the game is completely changed and it's no longer a realistic situation. And I wonder with Jurgen there, you know, we those are great results they got last month in Europe against the Netherlands and Germany, but you can't change the game that way in a competitive environment. And I think he does himself a disservice with, you know, sort of not really being prepared necessarily for what's called for in a situation like last night. So it's strange to see. And then again, on the other side, it was a little strange to see Andy Nahar, you know, Honduras' brightest player in the early going, come off pretty early in the second half. But I think that gives you a little bit of a hint at what these managers are trying to juggle with, you know, effectively three games in a week. And I would love to see a whole fleet of new faces come into the 11 for the U.S. I think there'd be a lot of benefits to that. And if Jurgen is honest with himself about what he got from the starting 11 last night, I think there would be a lot of motivational benefits to that as well. But we shall see. I wouldn't even attempt to predict what Jurgen's going to do next time out.
Well, let's flip this around real quick and just talk about Honduras briefly, Charlie, because I mentioned Jorge Luis Pinto and the difference in the approach and stance of Honduras last night, as opposed to what we might have expected under previous regimes. He did pull off Nahar. That was a questionable decision. They may have still had a chance to win that game. But as you said, he's trying to juggle some things. But what has Pinto brought to that team that, you know, certainly he had in Costa Rica that Honduras is now showing?
Yeah, he's had a bumpy start, right? I mean, the last year or so has been a rough one for Honduran footy, and they had a really sort of, I think, a long hangover from a really nightmarish World Cup experience in Brazil. But now we're seeing a little bit of what he did with Costa Rica. You know, they described last night's lineup as a 5-4-1, which was a formation he used pretty regularly with the Ticos. It's fascinating to watch the way in which they've seemed to have evolved a little bit more discipline, though. I think he's got them playing with a little bit more sense of clear collective purpose. The defensive structure, the competitiveness, you know, they were a tough team to break down last night. I mean, the U.S. did not create as much as we would have expected in the run of play. And they were pretty bright, you know, getting forward, finding spaces, carving open the U.S. back line, actually, with surprising regularity. So I think you're seeing a little bit more of a concept, a culture, I guess, and so that bodes well for Honduras, and I think it's going to make life tough for their competition in this group for that second spot.
All right, Charlie, that's the U.S. men's national team. We'll try not to overanalyze it too much. See what happens against Haiti on Friday, a game that while Haiti may have taken a step forward and certainly gotten out of the shadow of some distractions back at home and can actually focus on some of their soccer, the United States should be major favorites in that game. We obviously know that you've been covering the women's game for a long time, and I wanted to ask you, number one, your full tournament thoughts as the United States wins the World Cup on Sunday, and then also what you imagine will happen next and how women's soccer can capture some of this momentum in the U.S.
Yeah, it's an interesting moment. You know, I think as I was chided with some justification by a few of my colleagues yesterday, by already looking ahead to what this team has coming up. Yes, there's a grace period. Jill Ellis has won the World Cup. She's brought home the third star. You know, they've ended a 16-year championship, you know, world championship drought. So kudos to all that. Kudos to Jill Ellis for sorting things out on the fly. She had not shown a great deal of adventurousness or tactical flexibility in the year or so she'd been in charge in the lead up to this tournament. But they did. They made a significant change to their personnel and their formation in that tournament. And it, you know, I can't help but wonder how things would have gone if they'd figured that out sooner and why they had to be in that position. But the bottom line was they did. They got it sorted out, and now, you know, this is actually a relatively short turnaround. I do think they should enjoy the afterglow of this win. But the women's schedule, you know, the two biggest of world events and the events, at least for this team, are the Olympics and the World Cup. So now they have barely a year before the Olympics arrive, and they're defending, you know, three straight gold medals. So certainly that's a big event for them. They could effectively move forward with the same roster and take that game on a year older, a year wiser. But we're already seeing Lauren Holiday, as you know, announce her retirement. I expect there to be at least two or three more retirements from this team over the next couple months. They may, you know, ride it out through the victory tour and announce at some point there. But there's going to be, you know, there's also fewer roster spots on an Olympic team. So, is Ellis going to be the adventuring sort of problem solver she was in the past couple weeks, or is she going to revert to type and stick with what she knows? There's a lot of young talent coming up through NWSL, through the youth national teams. And to me, you know, the World Cup, if anything, should prove that there's real benefits to be had from blooding that youth. I mean, Julie Johnston and Morgan Bryan, the youngest two players on this team, were arguably the most important players on this team. And there's more where that came from. So I'd love to see her sort of, you know, stir in a little bit of competition, a little bit of youthful edginess to this group. But I have a feeling it may be in a very limited quantity. So, and you know, I've got to say too here, again, really got to emphasize to everyone, NWSL is going to be the key to developing this talent, to finding the next generation of players, not just kids, but, you know, seasoned pros that are working hard at that level. And it's key also for everything that the women's game needs to do off the field. Urge all your listeners to pay a little more attention than they might have before. Mm-hmm. If you can get to an NWSL game, go check it out. You know, let's try and sort of convert this great summer into a little bit more collective momentum for the game.
Well, you pointed to something on your Twitter account that I find interesting, and that's the competing interests that are pulling on these women in particular. You mentioned that, I think this, I'm pretty sure it was you, I apologize, I've been taking it a lot this morning, but the celebration tour, they're in LA Live yesterday, pumping up the crowd, singing "I Believe That We Just Won." They're going to be in, I know they're going to be in New York on Friday for Canyon of Heroes ticker tape parade that they absolutely deserve. I'm sure there's going to be something in between and after, et cetera, et cetera. And NWSL is going on right now, Charlie. So, how do they balance this out? I mean, they should absolutely have the opportunity to celebrate. I imagine there's some appearance fees that'll help them and their bottom line. We know that some of these women aren't making a ton of money outside of the ones with big marketing deals. So how does a top women's player who just won a World Cup balance out her club responsibilities versus, you know, celebrating and making some extra money, et cetera, et cetera?
Yeah, there's an interesting question of identity with these players. For a lot of them, you know, they are required, with one very prominent exception being made, they're required to play for an NWSL club. You know, that's part of their job as women's national team members. They are full-time employees of the federation, but that includes NWSL participation. And I should also, you know, point out that the all aspiring national team members for this World Cup cycle were effectively ordered to come home and play in this league so they could be watch on a regular basis so they could support the league. So there are players, you know, abroad and a very talented college product. Daphne Corbeau's just signed with Manchester City yesterday. And there's a very talented young striker named Lindsay Horan with PSG in France. These players are effectively cut out of the national team pool because they're not playing in NWSL. And in many cases, you know, they would be having to make significant financial sacrifices to play. But then, you know, there's national teamers who see it effectively as kind of a nuisance. They consider themselves international players first and NWSL players second. And there's others that are the opposite, that are very loyal, very committed to their NWSL club. So there's an interesting kind of balance there. I mean, we saw, you know, Abby Wambach took this year off and was given that exception to the rule by the federation. I get the sense that's something they keenly want to avoid going forward. They want these players sharp and competitive in that everyday club environment. But we'll probably see a little bit of the attitudes kind of reflect themselves in how these players go back to their duty. They certainly earned a week or two off from action on the field. I think they're going to get promoted heavily, even if they're not playing right away by their NWSL clubs. I expect them all to be appearing at NWSL matches this weekend and in the weeks ahead. But some of them are just not going to have that hunger necessarily to get back into things after such a draining World Cup experience. So I think it's important in the long term. And, you know, philosophically, the idea here is that these players are being tested and pushed week in, week out in the club situation. The reality is, has been a little sloppier. It hasn't quite gone to plan that way. Mm-hmm. But my understanding is there's important people within the Federation that really want to kind of press out some of those exceptions and try and get them on the same page, sort of get back out to the plan of making NWSL the proving ground.
Well, certainly there is a long-term vision that requires as much support for NWSL as they can muster. That requires, obviously, the biggest name players to be, as you said, at least there. Whether they're playing or not, is especially now with it with just coming off the World Cup and deserving of a break, maybe that's not as important. But they have to be involved somehow because NWSL can't survive without them. And but you don't also don't want to sacrifice. You don't want to alienate anybody, and you want to make sure that the NWSL is able to stand on its own two feet. And all of these things are all very complicated and mixed together, Charlie. And I guess what I'm saying is, the long term vision can't miss out on the details in the short term.
Yeah, it's true, and you know, I think if a federation, you know. Employee were to sort of answer this honestly, which would of course be off the record, I think they would say, listen, the women's national team is the engine that pushes NWSL. It's what funds it. The ticket sales from this victory tour are effectively going to pay for, you know, the salaries of these players. The visibility of the NWSL is far, far less than anything related to the women's national team. And, you know, the women's national team has always gotten priority. I mean, they were playing a friendly match in the midst of the NWSL playoffs last fall, which was sort of absurd when you looked at it. You know, this is a U.S. Soccer Federation founded and operated and subsidized league, and yet they're undercutting their own product by playing, you know, women's national team friendlies in the middle of the postseason. But the justification was, listen, this is all about the women's national team. This is all about winning a World Cup. You know, everything comes after that.
Well, now that job is done.
Great. You won a World Cup.
Yeah. Now that job is done, does it go back to the priority being making that the most legitimate competition it can possibly be? I mean, they had the league went on without the women, without the U.S. women's players, without, I'm sure, some international players as well. You know, I remember talking to Jeff Kasufa ahead of the tournament, and he's basically talking about what amounted to, I don't know, part-timers. I mean, we're talking about girls, women who come off, you know, just got out of college and weren't playing
amateur
professional
players,
amateur players or yeah, that's right. Amateur players who weren't making a paycheck to fill out the numbers. The league can't take on the importance that it needs to take on unless that shift happens. And now that the World Cup's won, can that shift happen?
I certainly hope so. I certainly hope it's a priority for the Federation to at least try, because it was questionable. My understanding was some markets in the U.S., some TV markets had NWSL promos happening, you know, during women's national team broadcasts this past month. I didn't see any myself. I think there was real missed opportunities. Unfortunately, it's the return of a pattern that we saw, you know, in the last World Cup and in the Olympics, where, you know, when you see these players making all these media appearances on all these big time mainstream outlets, and you know, their league and their club may not even get a single mention during that time. Well, you know, okay, I understand. You know, again, the women's national team comes first. That's the cash cow. But how are you going to transition? I mean, we're working on our third try of a women's professional league, and U.S. Soccer is not just sort of a philosophically aligned. They are literally running this league. They are only separate entities in name. You know, so what are you going to do to sort of add value to that product? It's a little bit more chaotic because you're dealing with 9 different owners. There's a huge range in resources and ambitions and organization, quite frankly, among those 9 clubs. It's a real spectrum. So I understand that it's a difficult sort of environment to work in. But when you compare it to what MLS did, you know, and there's people that think MLS overplayed that hand, but MLS had a bunch of players on last summer's men's World Cup team, and they promoted it to within an inch of its life, right? For Club and Country was the motto for the entire season for MLS. They made a big deal out of that sort of interwovenness. I really would like to see more of that on the women's side.
All right, Charlie, before I let you go, let me turn to the big signing up in New York. And I mean, on Andrea Pirlo, $8 million a year is his reported salary. I think that's all well and good. What happens here when we talk about these big signings, and it's going to happen with the next one. It certainly happened with Lampard and Gerrard, and for the foreseeable future. Is this sort of zero-sum game discussion about development and paying DPs? Just your thoughts on how MLS, and I think this is more of a perception problem than it is an actual zero-sum game where the money goes. But what is your, what do you think MLS needs to do to continue to make sure that they are developing the back end, the younger side of things, while also maybe pushing the marquee names as well?
Yeah, I made a comparison here, and I don't have full assurance on these numbers. I'm not certain. I think there's some exceptions that are made, but basically, my understanding is that the annual budget handed down, or you know, directive from MLS headquarters to the clubs is they can spend $150,000 a year on signing and paying their homegrown players. Right. The idea being, you know, we're told that homegrowns are the future of the league. They're the next generation. They're the key to sustainability in a number of different contexts. But you're limited to spending a pretty modest amount on them. And again, I think there are exceptions made here, and there's wiggle room. And the fact that I can't get anyone to give me a straight answer on the homegrown salary budget tells me that it's not a hard number. But when you compare that, you know, 1 year of Andrea Pirlo is going to pay for 53 years of signing your, you know, maxing out effectively your off the budget number for homegrown players. So that's just a little bit of a glimpse, a kind of a crude way to measure this. I totally get it. I understand the Pirlo signing. I think there's and the Lampard signing. You know, these are guys that bring not only a lot of buzz off the field, that sell tickets, that sell merch. They bring a level of professionalism that can impact their younger American teammates for many, many years. So there's a lot of win to it. And if it's, you know, if it's not your money, or if you have a enormous pots of money like some of these MLS ownership groups have, you know, go for it, right? But where is it headed? Who's his understudy? Is there a coherent plan here for what Pirlo's legacy is going to be, besides playing maybe a year and a half or 2.5 years and retiring to a beautiful home on the beach somewhere? What's he going to leave behind? Is he interested in that? Is the club interested in that? Does the club have a way to make sure that happens? Because I can look at some of the high-priced signings of the past and some of the foreign guys that have come over, and they did leave a legacy. I mean, we certainly have to say David Beckham did. Even more humble guys like Yuri Djorkaeff, you know, left a legacy with their clubs and taught guys before they moved on. So I think, again, this league finds itself in a really awkward position. And to me, the push-pull is you're using – you know, your left hand is trying to generate revenue to subsidize the more important long-term things that your right hand is doing. That's a really awkward mix. In the youth side of things, we see it, you know, with, you know, pay-to-play programs are trying to generate enough revenue to build the scholarship programs that can go and find talented kids who don't have the means, right, and pay their way.
Yeah.
This came up with DeAndre Yedlin's situation. You know, it's a whole other matter to get into, the training compensation case, but his club, you know, made a coherent, conscious decision. They're trying to find as many talents that they can subsidize their soccer grooming, right? But that's being paid for by parents somewhere else. And that can all come unraveling when you think about it, because you're effectively asking one set of parents whose kids aren't maybe quite as transcendentally talented to subsidize the poor kids who maybe do have that world-class talent that can be groomed. So that's an awkward gig, and I don't envy them for trying to do it. But I think there's a lot of questions to be answered about sustainability and long-term balance with this deal.
We won't be answering those questions today, but they are out there. We'll continue that discussion. Perhaps we'll have Charlie back to do that. Charlie Bohm from MLSsoccer.com, SoccerWire.com. Follow him on Twitter, CBOAHM. It's great to talk to you as always, Charlie, and hopefully we'll have you back soon.
Thanks, Jason. Have a great show.
Let's take a break. When we come back, phone lines will be open. You want to talk about that? Or the U.S. men's national team, or Lauren Holiday, or the women, or whatever is happening in WSL. Do that right now after the break. We'll be right back.
I got 5 broke strings on a broke guitar.
This week, the U.S. men's national team kicks off its campaign to try to win back-to-back Gold Cups for the first time since 2005 and 2007. As many of you know, the past month of Women's World Cup and Copa America coverage have been augmented by our sponsor, Rabble.tv. and giving people like me, Jerry Dubois, and Thomas Floyd an opportunity to provide you with an alternate commentary to several memorable games. Now that the Gold Cup is kicking off, we're going to continue our relationship with Rabble. Each U.S. game over the next week will feature a Rabble audio broadcast, including Friday's game, where I'll be bringing you USA against Haiti, as well as Monday, July 13th's game between USA and Panama, which will feature audio dialogue from World Soccer Talk's Kardish Krishnire. With Rabble, the concept is simple. All you have to do is tune into the broadcast on TV, press the mute button, and then head on over to Rabble.tv to listen to me sharing my analysis. And if you have an iPhone, install the Rabble TV app and add a comment to the broadcast message board, then listen live via the app. Cheer on the red, white, and blue with Rabble.tv today.
Welcome back to Soccer Morning on World Soccer Talk with Jason Davis.
Here we are back on a Wednesday, Soccer Morning. La, 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 la. Sorry, not going to sing on this show. That's not what I do. We talk about soccer on this program. Line up your phone calls, 646-832-3909. Tell me how you feel about the U.S. men's national team coming out of that game against Honduras last night. Let's start off that discussion. Al in Missouri, what's up, Al?
Hey, what's going on? I think we saw the game last night, and I tell you, I'm still concerned with that back line, you know, with Timothy Chandler back there. He was lost last night.
He always looks lost, doesn't he, Al? He always looks like he's just spinning around, doesn't he? Like, he gets upfield, and I'm like, no, don't do that, because next thing you know, and you know what? It is complicated by the fact that you got a player like DeAndre Yedlin with him. And Yedlin's instincts aren't, you know, his instincts might be to play defensive, but he's also got responsibilities going forward. He's also supposed to help possess the ball, and it just didn't work.
It didn't. It really didn't. I mean, I wish Jurgen Klinsmann would have started Brad Evans and Omar Gonzalez last night, because, you know, I think they would have been able to, you know, I think they would have been able to at least, you know, prevent, you know, Andy Nahar, you know, to just go through, like, you know, they wouldn't allow Andy Nahar to go through that back line like that, because Timmy Chandler just looked lost last night.
Yeah. No.
He could not stop him at all. And I'm like, this is going to be a long night. So we should just be relieved that we won 2-1 and everything. That wasn't against the victory at all, but coming up with some points like that is a relief.
Look, that's all that matters right now. I mean, I hate to be reductive here. I hate to put so much into the result and kind of avoid deeper analysis. And we did some of that with Charlie just now, Al, but the important thing is the 3 points. Because if you get those 3 points, you line yourself up. You got the inside track on the group now, because Panama and Honduras drew. Haiti drew. Panama and Haiti. So as long as you take care of your business, you come out of the group as the top seed. You go to Baltimore in the quarterfinals and take on, a pretty weak team that finishes third in their group, and you'll be all right.
Exactly.
You got anything else, Al?
Yes, one more thing on the National Women's Soccer League. They have a television. Did they sign with their television contract with Fox Sports 1?
They did sign a TV deal. I don't have the details in front of me. I'll pull those up. But I do know that most of the games that they're showing, I think it's one a week. I mean, it's a national TV deal, but it's basically one game a week, and I believe that it's all about two cities, Houston, which has a couple of stars, and then Portland, which has the big crowds. Here we go. I'm looking at the release here at World Soccer Talk, actually. On the heels of the successful run by the U.S. Women's National Team, Fox Sports has announced that a deal includes broadcast rights to 10 games from the NWSL. Deal includes 3 regular season matches, all 3 games from the playoffs, and 2 semifinal games in the championship. The final championship game on October 1st. They'll all stream on Fox Sports Go. Let's see. Blah 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 blah. Here's the schedule. Portland versus Seattle, Houston versus Kansas City, Portland versus Boston, Houston versus Sky Blue, Portland versus Chicago, Houston versus Seattle, Portland versus Washington. So every single one of these games is going to be broadcast either from Portland or from Houston. But I imagine there's some considerations there. And this is, again, a lot better than nothing.
Yeah, so I hope they do well, you know, and I'd like to see them expand just a little bit, maybe in St. Louis too, because they really, people in St. Louis, you know, they just, they're following the Women's World Cup all this past year and everything.
Yeah, they need to do something in St. Louis. Thanks for that call, Al. Appreciate it. It's good stuff from Al on a Wednesday. Let's move along. Let's talk to our friend Roberto up in Connecticut. What's up, Roberto?
What's up, Jason? I'm just waking up after that bitter performance last night in the United States.
There you called it bitter. Oh, it wasn't first gear. It wasn't a little herky-jerky. It wasn't a little rough. It was you're bitter? Or
yeah, bitter.
Bitter that they played like that.
Anxious, you know, nerve-wracking. Any other words similar to that?
Is watching the U.S. men ever not nerve-wracking?
No.
So why would you expect differently? I mean, Robert,
I have no idea.
Okay.
Well, but there are ways to say that. I mean, you're playing players out of position. Ventura, Alvarado didn't really have a great game, you know.
No.
What else do you want me to say?
No, I agree. Look, I agree with you. And look, we broke all that stuff down. With Charlie, I thought, while I was not surprised by that lineup whatsoever, based on what I know about Jurgen Klinsmann, he did, I mean, you could say Yedlin's out of position, Zardes is out of position, you've got two green center backs in Brooks and Alvarado, you've got a right back who hasn't played well for the national team ever, I don't think, and you've got a left back.
Oh, I know you're critical about Timmy Chandler.
Well, I mean, look, I don't think he's a good player on some level. It's just that he doesn't, for whatever reason, it doesn't work with the U.S. and he seems to be out of sorts. He doesn't seem to have a relationship with whoever's in front of him. He doesn't seem to know when to track back, or, you know, when to sit back and when to get forward. He always seems to be laboring. At one point last night, Honduras was creating a chance. Timmy Chandler is 2 yards from the ball and doesn't even make a feint towards it. To attempt to break up an attack. And I don't know what that is. I don't know if that's, he doesn't care. I don't know if it was, he was too damn hot. I don't know what it was.
No, something that caught my mind today was, why was there so many defenders on the far side of the goal during the corner in the first half? If you remember that.
I don't. It's all kind of a blur.
It was during the corner. There was like, six or seven players, like on the far end of Honduras' goal.
It was a U.S. corner kick, or was it
U.S. corner? I'm sure
there was a set play being run. Yeah, you're not talking about the first goal, are you?
No.
Okay,
it was before that.
Well, I mean,
just the one question. Who would you want to take out for the match against Haiti, in your opinion?
I would put, it depends on how far, I mean, I know you're asking me, not necessarily saying if you were Jurgen Klinsmann. I mean, you're asking me, not what I think Klinsmann will do. I would push Zardes up to a forward position. I think you can do that against Haiti and not really risk a whole lot. And I think he needs to. It'd be nice to have some confidence from him scoring some goals, perhaps, or scoring a goal. Beckerman's 33, and you maybe can't use him every time out. So perhaps this is a game for Mix Discaroo to step in. I think Greg Garza at left back and push Fabian Johnson into the midfield would be better. It would be a nice switch. On the other side, I think if Bedoya's healthy, I think you can go ahead and give him a run out as well. And then, center back, I'm swapping out one of those guys for Omar Gonzalez. I guess I'm thinking Alvarado.
Yeah, that seems perfectly fine. But, you gotta remember that this Haiti side gave Panama a battle, so.
No, I realize that, but that's still a strong enough team to win that game. If you could start Zardes with Dempsey, you still got Dempsey on the field, you still got Michael Bradley leading the charge. I think Discarude, while he can be choppy, is a decent enough player to create some chances and play that. I mean, he's not a natural holding midfielder, but he can play the role. Especially if the U.S. is going to have more of the ball, as they probably will against Haiti. I don't think Haiti's got the athletes to press them the way that Honduras did. So that's less of a concern. And now we've got a natural left back in Greg Garza in there. Pushing Fabian Johnson to the midfield helps with that possession as well. Helps to be more dangerous up the flank. And then on the right side, I didn't pick a new right back, but I would like to see a new right back. And, you know, why not somebody like Brad Evans, who at least I know is going to be pretty smart and not make a whole lot of mistakes?
Yeah, I was really impressed by him, Brad Evans, last night as well.
He did. He made a difference for them.
Yeah.
You got anything else?
Thanks, Jason.
All right, appreciate the call.
Thanks, Jason.
There goes Roberto. Let's switch over and talk to Bill in New York. What's up, Bill?
Hey, how's it going, Jason? I think I'm officially an old man now with this topic I'm going to bring up about the national team.
Okay.
Does it irk anybody that Joe Gi out the door doesn't put his hand over his heart?
Oh, my goodness. Here we go. Here we go, Bill.
Have you ever given a,
here we go,
have
Bill.
You given a reason? Like, is it a political reason or a religious reason?
I don't know.
That he doesn't do it?
I don't know, Bill. I don't. Maybe he feels Haitian enough that he just doesn't want to do it. I don't know. And I don't, you know, if I thought for a second that Josie Altidore was showing up every time the national team calls him up and not putting forth an effort or only, you know, only there for glory or something, then I'd have a problem with this. I don't have a problem with this. And again.
Well, he's always.
Go ahead. Sorry.
He's always going to put the effort up because it's better to his career. But you're representing our country.
Okay.
If you look down the line, when they show and they can the whole team, the players on the bench, every single player has their hand over their heart, and it just irks me. I don't know. Like I said, I'm officially an old man now.
Did he sing the anthem, Bill?
I don't know.
You were looking too. You were so focused in on the man's chest and his hand and whether it was there or not that you didn't even notice if he was singing the national anthem.
I don't think he was.
Okay. Well,
I don't know.
I would need to confirm that because I did not. I did not see whether or not he was singing. But you know, mainly because I'm sort of over this. I'm over this issue. And while in a perfect world, Bill, I would love for us to have an international game populated by players who are so passionate about representing their country that there are no questions. I realize where we are. This world has shrunk quite a bit. We are a nation of immigrants. We are a nation that has sent our fighting men overseas and where they have fathered children who have grown up in the German soccer system. I hate to take a cynical view, but they're all American. They're all eligible. If they all want to play, I'm more than happy to have them, and I'm not going to get too wrapped up in whether they're singing or have their hands over their heart. I am an American, and I'm proud of that, and I grew up in a military family, and that brings an extra little bit of patriotism my way, but I'm not necessarily going to go throw some stones at Josie Altidore for his hand or Timmy Chandler if he doesn't know the lyrics. I mean, I'm just not going to do that.
All right. Well, I'm sorry to bring that up.
No, it's okay. Okay.
Bring up one more thing about Red Bull.
Yes, sir.
They keep talking now about DPs, and I'm not hearing anything coming from the Red Bulls. And I actually heard some people saying, well, you know, they can't sign the big-name Red Bull. They can't sign the big-name DP. Why is that? We had Henri and Cahill last year.
Wait, who said that?
Getting the biggest DP in the league.
Who said that, Bill?
I keep hearing people on different podcasts. I keep hearing, they're not going to go for the big DP.
Oh, do you know what? But what they're saying is they're speaking from a practical point of view. They're speaking from what is pretty clear from the approach that Red Bull Corporate has laid out for this team. Thierry Henry retires, they drop Tim Cahill or they move him along. They've reformed this team very much in a, you know, for New York by relative standards, a budget minded image. They have the money to go out and buy a DP or sign a DP. They just don't want to do it.
And I just don't understand why not. You know, and I would think the league would be putting pressure on them to sign a big DP.
Well, what can the league is going to tell the boys in Austria how to spend their cash? I mean, the league can put all the pressure they want on New York. It's not going to make a difference if the corporate owners don't want to spend. Now, I don't think it's a matter of or should they or what or can they. I think it's a matter of whether or not it's best for their team. And certainly they seem to have a plan in place. And Ali Curtis has got 300 pages and maybe nowhere in those 300 pages. I think it's actually out there somewhere, but maybe nowhere in that 300 pages bill does it say sign big name DP.
Yeah, 'cause I think we're hanging on by a thread. You know, BWP, who is our DP, who really isn't a DP in most. He wouldn't be. He would probably be that core player that they're talking about now.
Sure.
If he goes down, we're in bad shape. You know, we need a big striker up there. We need somebody. And I thought there'd be some rumors out there right now about a big striker coming to New York, and I'm hearing none of it. Nothing.
Well, I mean, not that I would expect him to step right in and score the number of goals that BWP did, and but whatever. I mean, you know, Abong is a nice talent. At least you have that going for you. I'm not sure. Again, you don't want to hand the keys to the kid, but he scored a very nice goal last weekend, and he's obviously got some ability. You know, this is MLS, and it's difficult because depth is always going to be hard. You say we don't have anybody to turn to if BWP goes down, but you know, you'd be starting that player at the same time as BWP. You got to find room for him in the lineup. You got to find a formation that works with the other pieces that you have, with the Clushtons and McCartys of the world, and Felipe and everybody else. I'm not defending the Red Bulls not signing a big name player, but I'm saying a big name player doesn't necessarily make them a lot better, Bill.
No, and like, I think New York City is going to have a tough time with their big name players. You know, that's the Jason Christ. That's the anti-Jason Christ signing these three big name players. That's not the way he's built his teams in the past. And I think they're going to have a tough time. But there's no talk at all. And there's really very little talk about anybody coming into this team. And the window's open now. And I thought there would be some talk about it.
Yeah, you know, it is weird that the Red Bulls don't have that buzz around them. I mean, it's all been up north in the Bronx. And I don't think maybe that's part of that's part of the attitude with the Rebels. Maybe the attitude is let them go spend the big money and make the big splashes, and we'll just be the more successful team. And when it comes down to it, we'll be the one standing come playoff time, and we'll use that as our advantage.
Which I'd be very happy with, you know. But like I said, I think we're hanging on by a thread, and I think any one of our players goes down, we're going to need somebody, and I'm just surprised I'm not hearing anything about a DP. That's
need
all.
Somebody. Bill needs somebody. Thanks for the call, Bill. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Jason.
All right. 646-832-3909. If you have thoughts, comments, concerns, questions on anything we've covered today or anything else in the world of soccer for that matter, maybe you want to call in about Tottenham's new stadium, which looks great, I guess. You know, it's pretty. The renderings of the Spurs stadium, which apparently is going to host two NFL games a year, because we are just creeping closer and closer to an NFL franchise in London. Is that the right thing for them to do? I don't know. Whatever. I don't like the NFL in London thing. I'm not a big fan of that. Just I would be equally as opposed to the 39th game in the States, or whatever they would end up calling that thing. They played any competitive match, any really, truly important competitive match outside of England, that would be weird. And I mean, there's a little bit of provincialism on my part. Stay off of my turf. This is, you know, this is MLS, NASL, USL turf. We've got American leagues that people can go out and watch. We don't need your Premier League product coming over here. It might be the best thing for them business wise, but it is not really true to the spirit of the league and of the game, et cetera, et cetera. And I say that about the NFL. I say that about the Premier League as well. Let's go to Robert in LA. What's going on, Robert? Did you get enough shots of Pinto and Klinsmann last night on television?
Oh, it was very funny. Yeah.
What's on your mind today,
Why
Robert?
Why are you completely racking? Yeah, you know it was. Yeah, I did get enough. But
go ahead.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you. Because yesterday we had the women's team was here in downtown, like, you know, Rally Point.
Yeah.
I was just thinking about, and then they're also like talking about like next summer, you know, with the Olympics and how they're going to try and keep that court together. Do you think that they're still going to get big rains for just soccer in general? Because also next summer, I know it's like a year away, but do you think they can capitalize on it?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the U.S. women will have a nice little bump and people will start paying attention to them. I mean, next summer's a long way away, Robert. Who knows if they can maintain the momentum all the way through. I mean, I would hope that people watch NWSL, and I would hope that people will pay attention to whatever this team does between now and 2016. But yeah, there's never reason to think that people will stick. Not, you know, I don't know that they'll watch the Olympics in the numbers that are 27 million or whatever that is, but they'll watch. Yeah.
Well, I think like maybe this whole year, they will, because you know, they're going to go on the victory tour all around the country, and since the Olympics is going to be in Brazil, it'll still be prime time or good viewing hours for the American audience.
Yeah, I agree. Here you go, Robert. It's not a bad way to celebrate. I believe that we just won. Maybe there's a different tweak on it. I don't know if it's the best, but it's pretty good. I mean, it sounds pretty cool.
Yeah, can't wait to see what. Yeah, and credit to the Los Angeles area for pulling that off, like within 24 hours. Can't wait to see what they do in New York on Friday.
Absolutely, and there's going to be a City Hall presentation, City Hall ceremony there in New York. The two biggest cities in the country blowing off the doors for the U.S. women. Good stuff. Robert, you got anything else?
Yes, real fast. If it's not asking too much, could I get a soccer jersey number?
Sure. What do I got open for you right now, Robert? I think you're more than deserving. Let me see. Soccer Morning shirt numbers. I mean, I've only got a couple of people who have managed to get the honor. Washington's number 5, Rick and Philly's number 14, Eddie in Brooklyn is 7. We gave Roberto number 13, even though he was all super confused, and we'll give Robert, what do you want, Robert?
11.
Good stuff. Nobody wants that 10 shirts, just too much pressure. Robert, I appreciate the phone call, man.
All right, thank you.
Robert has been endowed with a Soccer Morning shirt number. For anybody who's confused about what the hell that means, it just means I'm honoring you. I'm giving you, as a regular caller who brings it every time you call and is consistent, giving you a shirt number on the imaginary Soccer Morning caller team that we're not putting together for real. If we actually ever did put it together, I'm not sure we would beat anybody, but it would be fun. As for this Bill issue with Josie Altidore, I don't want to dwell on it, but Womp X Stomp on Twitter. Bill, what law says we have to put our hand over our heart? Lots of us don't. Some of us put our hands behind our back and don't sing. I think as long as you are paying your respects, as long as you are standing still and paying attention, I'm not going to really have an issue. Now, you know, there are certain hand gestures you're not going to be able to do. I'm not cool with that. But if you're just standing there, and maybe you have your hands behind your back, maybe you're singing the song in your head. I don't want to make a big issue out of this. I just don't. I mean, I'm a stickler for rules a lot of times. I'm not going to be a stickler for these rules, especially in the modern world where national identity is a very fluid thing in 2015. It just is. Just a very fluid thing. So we talked about Tottenham and that stadium plan, the NFL playing there. They're going to have one of those retractable grass fields or something. I don't know. Something like they got it in Phoenix, which I think will work. Obviously, the NFL can do what, as Stephen Clark says, the NFL can do what they want at this point. It's not as if they're worried about fan retention, only expansion. I wonder what that's like. If you work in the offices of the National Football League, and you never really have to worry about losing fans. It just doesn't happen. You can have a concussion scandal. You can have domestic violence issues. You can have all of these things. Drug issues, drug scandals, PEDs, all of it. You can have all of those things, and you're not going to lose fans. You just know you're not going to lose any fans. They're going to stick around. And you're probably only going to get bigger. And I'm not necessarily sitting here rooting for the NFL to fail. I have an NFL team that I live and die with every weekend during the NFL season. But you have to wonder if there's some sort of bubble there, right? Is there an NFL bubble, or is that going to burst, or is that just, they're just going to go up and up and up and up and up and up and up until one day we live in the United States of the National Football League and the commissioner is our leader. And we televise, everything is based upon what team you support. And we're divided into tribes. I mean, I don't know. some dystopian future in which the National Football League dominates every aspect of life. Seems like that's a possibility. All right, let's wrap this up. Thank you very much to Charlie Bohm, MLSsoccer.com, SoccerWire.com, for joining us and breaking down the U.S. win over Honduras last night, the U.S. women, and a little bit about the development issues facing MLS as they sign big names like Andrea Pirlo. Go follow him, CBOEHM, on the Twitters. Thanks for listening. Be back tomorrow. Go to backheel.com/store, buy a mug. Go to 3nilfc.com, buy a t-shirt. Go to iTunes, give us a rating and review. Oh, and go get Bindle on your phone. It's a chat thing. There's a room. Hashtag soccer morning. Join us there. It's pretty cool. I want to try it out. Build a community. Hey, let's do that. See you there. Bye.